The time is now. Volume 8, Episode 143. This is Employment Law Now. I am Mike Schmidt, your host of this podcast and the Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department at Cozen O'Connor. Just 2 days ago, I gave you part one of this two-part series. I thought it was going to be a nice, simple, relaxed little federal agency update based on some of the letters of the alphabet. The letters D, E, F, and O. I gave you D, E, and F, and I was saving O for today's part two, but wow, we have had breaking news since just Monday, since just 2 days ago. That's my breaking news category, or really my since Monday category, because there have been two major developments since Monday's episode 142, and I want to get to those before I get to the letter O today. In fairness, these are not necessarily shocking developments, because I did talk about them on Monday and did tell you that things were happening and likely to happen any day. But with regard to the D and the F, there have been significant developments and updates, and I want to get to those right now. First, with regard to D, the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor, as I had told you on Monday, was about to issue its final rule on the overtime exemption change that it was going to be making. It had just cleared White House review and was ready to be released, and it was just released. So, here's what has happened. The Department of Labor has increased the minimum salary threshold in order to classify somebody as an exempt employee for purposes of federal minimum wage and overtime, and they have done so in a two-phased approach. The new rule will become effective on July 1st, 2024, and when it becomes effective, the first tier of the new minimum salary threshold will take effect. Right now, as it currently stands, putting aside state law, but under the federal law for purposes of the FLSA overtime exemptions and the minimum wage exemptions, somebody needs to be paid a minimum of $684 a week, which comes out to an annualized salary of $35,568. Beginning on July 1st, 2024, again, when this new rule becomes effective, that will rise to a minimum salary of $43,888, or $844 per week. So starting July 1st, 2024, the minimum salary threshold will be $43,888 or $844 per week. For those meeting the highly compensated employee test, which still has a standard but a more relaxed standard than the typical duties tests, that minimum salary threshold will go up from $107,432 per year to $132,964 per year, beginning again on July 1st, 2024. That first tier is short-lived only for the last half of 2024, because on January 1st, 2025, the second part of this phased approach will kick in. And therefore, in order to meet the minimum salary threshold for federal law purposes, an exempt employee will need to make $1,128 per week, which is equivalent to $58,656 per year. The highly compensated employee test will also rise on January 1st, 2025, to the sum of $151,164. The new rule also then puts in a mechanism that starting July 1st, 2027, and every 3 years after that, there will be a new mechanism to set the new salary level for those every 3 year deadlines. So, what did the final rule do and what did the final rule not do? Well, let's start with the latter. As we told you on Monday, the final rule is not making any changes to existing job duties requirements, right? The second bucket, you have to have the minimum salary threshold and then you have to meet the job duties requirements. There is no change to the job duties requirements. As the Department of Labor says, it kept constant in both its 2016 and 2019 rules. The Department of Labor says in its final rule, quote, it favors keeping the current standard duties test, which is well known to employers and employees. As long as it is paired with an appropriate salary level requirement, the standard duties test can appropriately distinguish bona fide EAP employees from non-exempt workers, EAP employees being exempt under the primary white-collar exemptions. So, that's what the final rule is doing. Not a whole heck of a lot of controversy, except for those who believe that the minimum salary threshold is too high, or that the Department of Labor should not or is not authorized to have this automatic mechanism set the new salary thresholds every 3 years. So that's what it does. Again, starting on July 1st, 2024, the federal minimum goes up to $43,888 per year, or a minimum of $844 per week. And then starting January 1st, 2025, that goes up to $58,656 per year, or $1,128 per week. If you are in a state where the state minimum salary threshold is higher than that still, you must follow the higher state amount in order to be properly classifying your employees as exempt under both federal and state. So the Department of Labor does this because it wants to cover more individuals and provide more money to more individuals. According to the final rule, the Department of Labor estimates that in just the first year alone, the new rule will impose approximately $1.4 billion of direct costs on employers. It will result in the first year income transfer of approximately $1.5 billion from employers to workers, primarily from new overtime premiums or from pay raises that employers are going to have to do to maintain the exempt status of those individuals who are impacted by this. So, what do you do as an employer? Assuming there is no legal challenge to this rule and it does go into effect starting July 1st, 2024, if you are not in a state where the state threshold is already higher than this new federal threshold, you need to make a decision as we talked about on Monday. You either need to reclassify your previously exempt employees so that they are non-exempt and then act accordingly with everything that goes along with that, including record-keeping obligations and, of course, paying overtime for those who work more than 40 hours in a work week. Or if you want to maintain their exempt classification, you will certainly have to raise the base guaranteed salary for those individuals if they are currently lower than what the new salary threshold will be. So, that was what the Department of Labor did. Unbelievable, right? We'll see if there's litigation. We will keep you updated to the extent there is any litigation affecting the July 1st, 2024 effective date of this new final rule. More to come. Also, in our Since Monday category, for the letter F, we've got a big update from the FTC. I told you on Monday that there was going to be a vote on Tuesday, the 23rd at 2 p.m., where the FTC was likely to announce its proposed final rule on the non-compete issue. And the FTC did do just that yesterday. So like the EEOC's Pregnant Workers Fairness Act vote, the FTC voted along party lines and by a 3-2 Democratic majority voted yesterday to issue its final rule that essentially finds non-compete agreements violate the FTC Act. Non-compete agreements violate the FTC Act. Let that sink in for a little bit. The FTC says that it reviewed over 26,000 comments, which is not surprising. And right in the beginning, right at the start of the new FTC rule, it says very succinctly, quote, "The commission thus adopts a comprehensive ban on new non-competes with all workers," end quote. And the rule is wide sweeping. In its current form, and if allowed to proceed, all non-compete agreements entered into on or after the effective date will be deemed to violate federal law, the Federal FTC Act, as constituting unfair competition, and would be banned. So we will now, again, if this law is allowed to proceed, there will be a federal law banning all non-competes. So let's talk a little bit about what this new broad rule does and what it doesn't do. First of all, when it comes to non-compete agreements beginning or entered into on or after the effective date, and the effective date is 120 days after this rule is published in the Federal Register. So all agreements, all non-compete agreements entered into on or after the effective date will be banned, will be prohibited, regardless of the type of employee, regardless of the salary or the level or the seniority of the employee, they will all be banned as a matter of federal law. Huh. But here is where there is some distinction. Let's talk about a couple of changes from the 2023 proposed rule. And the significant one deals with retroactivity for already existing non-competes. And here's where the final rule introduces the term senior executive employee. If you are a senior executive employee and you have a non-compete agreement entered into prior to the effective date, this final rule does not render those void retroactively. So, unlike the 2023 proposed rule, the new final rule says that if you are a senior executive and you entered into a non-compete prior to the effective date, there is no change. That non-compete agreement can still remain in place. The FTC essentially reasoned that for those individuals, we don't think there's the same level of coercion, duress, and undue influence as we do for lower wage workers, including for those who entered into non-compete agreements prior to the effective date of this new rule. So let's talk about some definitions. What does the final rule say is a non-compete clause? The final rule defines a non-compete clause as a term or condition of employment that prohibits a worker from, penalizes a worker for, or functions to prevent a worker from, one, seeking or accepting work in the United States with a different person where such work would begin after the conclusion of the employment that includes the term or condition, or two, from operating a business in the United States after the conclusion of the employment that includes the term or condition. How does the final rule define worker? Again, it doesn't just refer to non-competes with employees. It's much broader than that. So the term worker is defined as a natural person who works or who previously worked, whether paid or unpaid, without regard to the worker's title or the worker's status under any other state or federal law, including but not limited to whether the worker is an employee, independent contractor, extern, intern, volunteer, apprentice, or a sole proprietor who provides a service to a person. The term worker goes even as far as including a natural person who works for a franchisor or a franchisee. But it does not include a franchisee in the context of a franchisee-franchisor relationship. Wow, pretty broad, huh? So again, let's talk a little bit about this definition of senior executive, because the distinction only matters for non-competes that are existing as of the effective date. To be clear, on or after the effective date of this final rule, it doesn't matter what level employee you are. All non-competes will be deemed void for all employees. However, for existing non-compete agreements entered into prior to the effective date, if you are not a senior executive, those previously existing non-compete agreements are void, and employers must affirmatively provide those individuals notice that the pre-existing non-competes are no longer enforceable. The final rule even provides model language that would satisfy the rule's notice requirement. If, however, you are a senior executive, then the pre-existing non-compete may still be in effect. And the final rule defines senior executive as those employees who are in a policy-making position and who make at least $151,164 per year. $151,164 per year, and they are in a policy-making position. Presumably, we will see litigation if this rule continues in effect. We will see litigation over whether certain classifications of positions are actually policy-making positions, in fact. Another slight change from the 2023 proposed rule, there is no reference specifically to a ban on what was referred to as de facto non-compete clauses. But again, as I just read to you, the final rule does clarify the definition of a non-compete clause. And so the language in here, which says that a non-compete clause includes a term or condition that, quote, functions to prevent a worker from, end quote, doing what is defined as a non-compete clause, that opens things up to potential litigation on certain really broad confidentiality or really broad non-solicit provisions, even though the final rule does not on its face seem to prohibit confidentiality or non-solicit provisions. So, what does the rule ultimately and specifically prohibit? Well, for everybody, all classes of worker, after the effective date of this final rule, companies cannot enter into or attempt to enter into non-competes. Companies cannot enforce or attempt to enforce non-competes, and companies cannot represent to the worker that the worker is subject to a non-compete. What else? The 2023 proposed rule had a 25% threshold for a sale of business, exception to the rule. This final rule eliminated the prior 25% 5% threshold. In other words, the 2023 proposed rule says that non-competes would be allowed if there was a transfer of the entire business or at least 25%. That 25% of the business has been eliminated. So there is no longer a prohibition on non-compete agreements entered into when there is a sale of a business of less than 25% of the business. Again, this new rule, this new broad rule, will become effective 120 days after it is published in the Federal Register. However, we anticipate that there will be litigation at any moment. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as well as other large business groups, have promised there will be litigation, and we expect there will be litigation, primarily challenging the FTC's authority to issue this final rule. In fact, the two Republicans that voted against issuing the final rule yesterday raised the authority of the FTC as one of the primary reasons for voting against it. So we will see what happens. For now, as of this very moment, there is federal law that bans all non-compete agreements beginning on the effective date of this new law, which will become effective 120 days after it's published in the Federal Register, and does require employers to void and give notice of the voiding of all pre-existing and current non-compete agreements entered into with non-senior executives. What a dramatic change to the employment law landscape when it comes to non-compete agreements. We will absolutely keep you posted on whether litigation is filed, and most importantly, whether there is any temporary injunctive relief entered that might delay the effective date of this very broad and expansive FTC rule. So those are our two updates, significant ones from both the United States Department of Labor and the Federal Trade Commission. Let's now move to a development with the other federal agency that I wanted to get to in my part two of this two-part series, dealing with the letter O for OSHA. We heard a lot from OSHA when it came to the COVID-19 pandemic, when we were talking about vaccination rules and related issues relating to remote work and safety for those who had to be in the workplace during the pandemic. OSHA is now making a bit of a comeback. Have you ever heard of a walk-around rule? It's not your usual acronym, and it's not your usual legalese-sounding name for a new regulation or rule, but OSHA just recently issued a walk-around rule that employers should at least be aware of. You may have read something, you may have heard something, but there has been a good amount of buzz about OSHA's new walk-around rule. And for this one, I am bringing in a colleague to sort of help sort through it. John Ho is a partner of mine in Cozen's Labor and Employment Department. He is also the co-chair of our firm's OSHA Workplace Safety Practice. Particularly impressive is the fact that John is a former OSHA prosecutor at the Department of Labor and frequently speaks and is quoted on these various issues. John is here to talk about the new OSHA walk-around rule. John Ho, my terrific partner based here in New York, but of course with a national practice. Thanks so much for coming on to the podcast.
Always a pleasure, Mike.
So tell us a little bit about the nature of your OSHA practice and the work you do in this area.
Sure. So I'm a co-chair of Cozen's OSHA Safety and Health Practice, along with Jim Sullivan, the former chair of the OSHA Commission. As you mentioned, we have a national practice here, so it runs the whole gamut throughout the country, including state OSHA law, state OSHA plans as well. We can help you with everything safety and health, also consultants, internal safety audits, of course, contesting, litigating citations with OSHA and hopefully resolving them.
So I like to not assume when we have these kinds of subject matter episodes, I like to not assume that everybody out there knows or has some fundamental level of knowledge or expertise in this area. So let's start out with a little bit of that. A lot of people out there either don't know what OSHA is, or if they know what OSHA is, they think of OSHA as something that applies just to maybe construction sites or factories. Can we level set here a little bit to start and talk about what is the overarching purpose of OSHA and to whom does it apply?
Sure. So if you had asked me that question, Mike, pre-COVID, I think I probably would have agreed with you a little bit more wholeheartedly that a lot of employers probably had not heard of OSHA, but obviously having, you know, all of us gone through that whole quote unquote thing, you know, obviously OSHA was in the press a lot more, and businesses outside of these high hazard industries that you'd mentioned, like construction or manufacturing, had a lot more exposure to OSHA, right? With the vaccines and the social distancing and all that. But yeah, to your point, I think, you know,
I should have just started this by saying, you know, go back and listen to the episodes from 2020 and 2021, and you'll get a pretty good familiarity with OSHA. You're right. I should have said that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and look, I mean, that's not to say, you know, obviously COVID is a very specific hazard, and, you know, hopefully that's all in the rearview mirror now. But so even though, you know, a lot of companies like take a law firm, for example, that, you know, generally is probably not going to have a whole lot of OSHA issues to deal with, even though they may be more familiar, you know, with OSHA is as an agency, right? That it's out there. It's a federal agency that protects and enforces safety and health standards for all private sector employers. And I just mentioned in our, you know, the question before, there, you know, our practice also covers state OSHA plans. So there's about 22 or so states and U.S. territories that essentially has petitioned to OSHA and got certified that they can run their own programs. For the most part, they share, you know, they're very similar to OSHA under the certification rules. They have to provide at least minimum level of OSHA protection, if not more. I think the most well-known state OSHA plan is CalOSHA, right? Which, you know, often has standards that exceed what OSHA actually provides. But otherwise, yeah, it is an agency that affects pretty much most businesses, whether you are in manufacturing or construction, you know, or retail, unless you're covered by one of those state plans. So you may not have a lot of practical exposure to it, but you are going to be covered under, you know, a lot of their regulations.
And you're right, CalOSHA out on the West Coast gets a lot of attention. I mean, are there a lot of states that have their own sort of state OSHA plans? Is there a trend towards states adopting that more? We've seen this more as an activity on the state and local level.
No, I don't think there's been too much there. Actually, I think, you know, as, you know, California, right, that the People's Republic of California, right? I mean, obviously, they are certainly one state that has, you know, sort of always gone above and beyond what federal standards are. And in the safety and health arena, it's no different. There was some discussion, I think it was Arizona, but I could be wrong, that there was a little bit of a dispute of whether, you know, they were going to, OSHA was considering even pulling certification. But no, I there's really, that's sort of been static. As I mentioned, I think it's about 22 or so states with the U.S. territories that run their own plans. But like I said, you know, outside of CalOSHA, most of them are mimicking federal OSHA to a great degree, and just following those guidelines, but just essentially doing it themselves.
So against that backdrop, there has been a recent development in the OSHA world that has garnered a little bit of buzz, this new so-called walk-around rule. We've seen a lot of press, hearing a lot from people on it. What is the walk-around rule in a nutshell?
Sure. So the walk-around rule is a rule that addresses OSHA's inspection procedure. So if OSHA does come knocking at your business, part of the main component of an inspection is doing a walk-around, and that's where the COSHA, it's for short, and as a former government U.S. DOL person, I sort of fall into using these acronyms, but compliance safety and health officer, the COSHA will do a walk around through your facility, right? And hopefully, you know, you've worked with the COSHA to sort of target and limited the scope. But essentially, as they do that walk around, an employer representative has a right and always should be there with the co-sho doing the walk around. But then on the other hand, an employee representative also has a right to be, to participate with the walk around with the co-sho. So
when you say the, co-show, the rule, let me stop you there. Who are you referring to? Who are you referring to there?
The employee representative.
No, when you say the co-show, you said
the compliance safety and health officer. That is the OSHA inspector.
Got it.
Yeah,
okay.
You know, okay. These acronyms just come a little over 20 years. I just assume everybody knows them, but of course, you know, that's not the case. So during the inspection process, an employee representative has a right to participate in the walk around with the co-sho. So prior to this new rule change, OSHA had, you know, the regulation pretty much said, you know, it needed to be an employee of the employer with limited exceptions. And that limited exceptions was identified as safety engineers and industrial hygienists. So what the new rule says is it broadens that and says it can be a third party representative. So it doesn't have to be the employee representative, does not have to be employed by the employer. So, you know, obviously a third party. So that's, OSHA calls it a clarification of the rule. Again, the prior rule had allowed for third parties, but it was interpreted as specifically just safety engineers and industrial hygienists. Now, the clarification goes on to state it could be a third party, not just limited to those two credentials and somebody else. So
could be a lawyer, could be an employee's lawyer.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that is a one bucket of categories where employers should be concerned if it is a lawyer. But the new rule is clear, right? And they obviously got a lot of public commentary from businesses and industry groups expressing a lot of these concerns. Obviously, unionization, you know, was one. They didn't, if you're not unionized and a union was sniffing around and looking to unionize you, how is that, you know, is this going to be used as a weapon, right, as opposed to a defensive shield? But yeah, I mean, I think those are the buckets of categories that rightfully so deserve some deliberation on how you want to handle that. But that's really what the newer rule does. It talks about who can serve as the employee representative, and now has expanded that to other third parties, such as those that we just talked about.
Who gets to select the employee representative?
The co-sho makes that determination. So the co-sho has to, the standard reads, it has to, the co-sho has to find that the employee representative is reasonable, necessary to an effective investigation. And so some of the factors the co-sho will consider is, does this employee representative have the knowledge, skills, experience with, for example, a particular hazard in the workplace, or the regulations talk about language barriers. Can they help out because they can facilitate, you know, communications? So they list some factors that the co-sho will look to determine whether that person is reasonably necessary to enhance an effective investigation.
So it's not exactly like, you know, an employee kind of discipline meeting where an employee can have, you know, really anybody in the meeting. Presumably that eliminates bringing a friend or a neighbor as the employee representative. It may foreclose the use of an attorney if that attorney, I guess, doesn't meet the criteria also.
Right. And that's exactly right, Mike. Look, if you know, God forbid, a business has a mass catastrophe, right, where a lot of people have died or injured, and all of a sudden the law firm that is representing those folks with a, you know, with a negligence or a tort claim says, I want to be the employee representative, I think that lawyer, like, unless they have some kind of, you know, very unique skill set with that particular hazard.
Yeah.
Right. I think they're going to have a hard time demonstrating to OSHA that, you know, that lawyer is reasonably necessary to an effective investigation. Right. And so those are some of the things that an employer can do, I think, ahead of time to make sure that doesn't happen, right? You can think about those issues, think about who could sort of be a problem for us and come up with an agreement, right? Because that you want this third party representative to sign, right? That says, look, we'll let you come in, but you have to agree X, Y, and Z, right? You can't speak with employees. You can't, you know, you can't make demands about like preservation of evidence, right? All of these things that don't go towards a safety and health inspection, but rather collateral issues. And you know, most lawyers aren't going to want to sign something like that and limit themselves. And you can say, oh, so look, this, you know, this obviously is not about safety and health. It's about building a case, right? So, you know, and that's where I think from our practical standpoint, it, you know, most co-chairs are going to be sensitive to that. And obviously you can speak with area directors and go above that if, you know, we have disagreements and hopefully you can work it out.
So from a process standpoint, just so I understand this then, and I think what you said is the COSHO is making the determination as to whether the individual representative is appropriate. How do we get to that point? Does the employee himself or herself sort of make a request to somebody that, hey, I want this person as my designated representative? And then if the employer doesn't agree, COSHO has to make the determination. How does that work that we end up with potential representatives?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And frankly, there's no one single way that it works. But like, let's take the situation where it's really, there's no dispute of who the employee representative, right? Say the business has a union, right? So it's clear that the highest ranking union official, right, is going to, you know, will determine who the employee representative is. And, you know, I think it's going to be hard for any employer to say, they're not appropriate, right? You're unionized. That's who your union rep is. So that's fine. So, you know, take the, you know, the situation now where it's, you know, the rules now are interpreted to be much broader and there's no union, right? So the OSHA's published recently some FAQs on this and it says, look, one employee cannot make that designation, right? So it can't be like the one bringing the lawsuit, you know, in our sort of last example. It has to be more than one, but how they designate, it could happen a lot of different ways. If the employees file a complaint, they can say, we want this person to be the expert during the walk around process. It might start with no employee walk around, but as OSHA talks with employees, it may come up, hey, you know, this person would be good to help you. So it could happen a lot of different ways, but the COSHO, what's clear is the COSHO doesn't designate. The COSHO doesn't come in and say, I want this person to be the employee representative, but how it gets to the COSHO, it can get through a number of ways. Again, as I said, it's through the complaint process, but when they file a complaint, and OSHA comes in or at that time, or if there's a safety committee, the safety committee could designate that person through the employee part of that. So it can work a number of different ways.
Where are we procedurally with the walk around rule here? Has it gone into effect yet?
It has not. It's been published in the Federal Register. The effective date is May 31, so right around the corner.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to get to sort of challenges to the implementation and what the likelihood is that date is a real date. But I want to ask you, is this rule a big deal? We're hearing a lot about it. We're reading a lot about it. You know, OSHA says something and we get some buzz. Is this walk around rule a big deal to you?
Well, look, I mean, anytime you have a third party non-employee on your premises, I mean, that is obviously going to create some natural concern for employers, and I think rightfully so. You know, to be blunt, I think as a practical level, I don't think a lot of employers can be getting into a whole lot of fights over this, right? Because again, if you're unionized, you know who the employee representative is, and quite frankly, and I think you would agree with this, Mike, that, you know, the vast majority of employers want to do the right thing, right? Particularly when it comes to safety and health, right? So if the employees get together and you're in a very unique industry, like you're a chemical manufacturing plant where certain types of gases are released and they, you know, they say, look, this is like a national expert on this. We want this person to come in. I think most employers are probably going to be okay with that, right? As long as there are certain sort of precautions protecting proprietary information, right? Because if that third party expert can really lend a hand to the inspection and make some recommendations that strengthen employers, you know, safety practices, I think most employers are going to, quite frankly, welcome that and want to listen to it. Obviously, you know, they have to be reasonable and right. But at the end of the day, I mean, they, you know, the initial thought that I want to sort of fight anybody who comes in, I think we, you know, employers need to take a step back and really do an analysis. Okay, who are they designating to be? And so what are my real concerns? Can this person really help the investigation? And look, as I said, there's been a lot of comments, you know, before to OSHA about these concerns with unionization, and they've responded to them. And OSHA makes clear that, look, this is not a union solicitation issue, right? And so they have to really be there. Their purpose has to be to aid the investigation. So as long as you get ahead of some of those issues, and there's some things employers can do to do that, I don't think it, you know, most employers are going to run into issues that on a practical level where this is going to, you know, be a big problem, quite frankly.
And so the walk-around rule obviously is impacted when you have an OSHA inspection or investigation. And this may not be an easy question to answer, but what prompts an investigation or an inspection in the first place? And are these typically random? Are they just showing up at an employer's office or facility?
Yeah, they usually happen with an employee complaint, right? If a series of, if a, and it could doesn't or doesn't or our former employee for that matter, they call OSHA and they report something. You know, OSHA, you know, if it's not sort of serious enough, they'll just get what's called a, you know, a rapid response investigation letter. They won't actually come. You know, but if OSHA looks at the complaint and obviously they think this is could be, you know, this is more serious, imminent, you know, death or bodily harm, then they can come in and do an unannounced inspection. The other way is under OSHA rules, you have to re affirmatively report certain industries, right? Obviously, fatalities, loss of an eye, amputations, serious injury reporting. 8 hours for fatalities, 24 hours for inpatient hospitalizations, amputations, and loss of an eye. A lot of times when the employer self-reports those as they have to, then OSHA, because by definition they are serious injuries, you know, will most likely come in and do an inspection. So those are two very common ways that you get the knock at the door.
So OSHA gets the comes over to your office, your facility. They knock on the door. They say that, well, I'm here to do an inspection or an investigation. What if the employer says, no, you're not coming in?
Well, they can say, no, you're not coming in without an inspection warrant, right? And so then OSHA will then go and get an inspection warrant and then come back with a warrant. Now, I can just share with you that, you know, I think it's fair to say, you know, having done this on the defensive side for 20 years, that most of us on the management bar don't recommend asking OSHA for an inspection warrant. Field operation handbooks makes clear that, you know, if they do, if an employer does, you can't like hold that against the employer. But again, coming back to what it says on the paper. And so the practical reality is if you do, I think the inspection can turn much more aggressive. So most of us just want to work with the COSHO, limit the scope of the inspection. What are you here for? Is it this injury? Okay, fine. Let's look at this piece of equipment. This is not an okay to walk around the entire facility, right? And these are all parameters. And again, hopefully, you know, most businesses, but particularly if you're in those high hazard industries like construction or manufacturing, you've got a plan already, right? What will you do when OSHA comes knocking? And these are sort of part of those guidelines. Talk with the COSHO, limit the inspection, so you're all on the same page of what, you know, the COSHO is looking at. And then you can work it out. And that's why we normally, you know, stress cooperation. There's some nuances, Mike, like OSHA's using drones more. Right. So drones may be, and there's some recent memorandum sort of talking about, you know, the use of drones where that is so new that I might be more open to asking for a search warrant, right? Because just the novelty of it and, you know, OSHA's got this plain sight rule where if they walk in, even though they're looking at a particular piece of equipment, if they walk by a emergency exit door and it's blocked, you can get a citation for that, right? It's in plain view during their inspection. And drones obviously provide a sort of a unique perspective because you can see the whole facility. And it's still not common. I think becoming a little bit more common, but normally you have the right again to ask for the inspection warrant, but for the most part, you just try to cooperate with OSHA to limit the scope and
And
you
so
don't need to
I'm
do that.
interested in the practical timing of all this then, coming back to the walk around rule. So you have an OSHA inspector come knock at the door. I'm here to do an inspection or investigation. From a timing standpoint, when does the conversation happen, as you said, about the scope of it, limiting it to certain areas, and to the point of this walk around rule, you know, when are you designating who the representative maybe you have somebody come into your facility right then. It's not so easy to, you know, get on the phone or bring somebody in who's going to be that employee representative who's now allowed under this rule to be there. How does this all play out from a timing standpoint?
Well, again, I mean, there are rules that you can OSHA cannot, you know, it's actually illegal to have, generally speaking, OSHA tell you when they're coming in. So they're going to be unannounced inspections, right? And so when OSHA comes in from the employer side, right, the employer representative, hopefully you know who that is, right? And they give you a reasonable amount of time. In my experience, like an hour would be, you know, would be somewhat reasonable to bring that person in, whether it's an attorney, the plant manager, you know, whoever, your safety officer. But then on the employee side, again, I mean, that's not really the concern of the employer, right? So if the employees already know who that is, when they come knocking, right, the employees may say, oh, OSHA's here, and they may go up to the COSHO and say, look, we want this person to be our employee representative. Again, if it's the union, it's easy. They ask, is the worksite unionized? Who's the highest ranking union member? So, and look, again, if there's a safety committee, right, that safety committee could have procedures. When OSHA comes in, this is who we designate. But in terms of who the third party expert is, that's really on going to be on the employees to make that determination. So if they come in, you know, if you don't know, they'll normally come, they'll do what's called an opening conference, and they'll sit down with the employer representative. And if there's no union and the employees aren't saying we want this person to be the employee representative, then the inspection will generally be done without an employee representative.
And like virtually all agency action these days, I suspect there will be or there have been challenges to the implementation of this new walk-around rule. Have there been, and from your standpoint, do you see any of the challenges out there likely to succeed, or do you think the walk-around rule will become effective in its May effective date?
Yeah, I'm aware that there are a number of industry groups looking to mount, you know, as you said, like it happens all the time. Every time a new rule comes out, legal challenges. I don't think I've seen any lawsuits filed yet on it. I'm just sort of enjoying it. But quite frankly, Mike, I mean, unlike, you know, the vaccine stuff, I mean, I think OSHA is going to be on much stronger grounds on this. Again, you know, it's sort of the rule has way back in the day was interpreted much more broadly like it is today. And then OSHA sort of backed off that and then limited it to just your safety engineers and hygienists. So even the rule that this will replace once it's effective allowed for third parties. But so OSHA even calls it a clarification, and there is some, you know, decisions that support that's fine. So I mean, I'm not optimistic that it will be reversed. The only caveat to that, Mike, is the, you know, the Supreme Court is, you know, we're all waiting on the Supreme Court and seeing what they're doing with this Chevron deference case. So if they, you know, if they eliminate Chevron deference, right, I mean, this is a rule, it's a government interpretation, that might have some impact. But quite frankly, if that happens, this is going to be the last thing that employers going to have to sort of be struggling with. There's going to be a lot of other government agency rules that are going to be sort of higher up on the, that they're going to have to deal with. But so I think there are OSHA's on pretty good legal ground, again, subject to what that deference case sort of does. And that's just overall.
So in conjunction with these OSHA inspections and more specifically the walk around rule, are there any kind of action items that employers should be thinking about doing right now in light of this new rule?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think what you just want to, right, preparation is key, right? As I don't think from a practical standpoint, a whole lot of employers are going to find themselves in a situation where an employee representative is going to be objectionable. And I think they just have to take a step back. And just because somebody is a non-employee doesn't mean they can't be helpful, right? So if it is an expert on a particular hazard in your workplace, you know, you may want to listen to what that expert has to say, right? As long as, again, right, it's not part of a union organizing campaign. So you have to sort of give that some thought. And what OSHA's, you know, talks about is, look, like you can have these third party people sign confidentiality agreements as long as you have other people sign them, right? So sort of, you know, HR 101, right? Sort of treat everybody similarly and just don't enforce the rule selectively. So one thing I strongly suggest, you know, for certain businesses, if you've got proprietary information, you know, whether it's your manufacturing process, your equipment, whatever it may be, if you haven't looked at that in a while, you should take a look at it, right? And sort of determine exactly what needs to be protected. Have an agreement in place already that you enforce, not just with, you know, third party representatives through an OSHA inspection, but everywhere, right? Any third party visitor, right? So you can say to OSHA, look, we make everybody sign this. So this person needs to sign it. In fact, you know, 2 months ago when so-and-so came, right, from a, you know, whatever it may be, you know, a litigation or something to that effect, we enforce this uniformly. So just make sure that with OSHA, you know, any third party that has access to your facility, that you understand exactly the areas that you need to protect and draft your agreements accordingly so you can be prepared. So if somebody like an expert does come in and you don't necessarily mind them coming there, if they can come up with some good ideas to help you strengthen safety policies, that, you know, you have something in hand that they can, execute. And I think for, you know, for businesses that have, you know, union avoidance, you know, strategies, that this needs to be considered, right? Because again, I think OSHA in their commentaries and their response to the commentaries is very aware of the issue that employers are raising. Look, we don't want this to be, you know, a way that we can be unionized more easily. And they recognize that. And so I think you can, when you build into your union avoidance campaign, look, if you hear of a union sniffing around, document it, right? Say, look, they tried to get cards on this day. So when they come in for an OSHA inspection, say, oh, we want this union rep, you can say to OSHA, look, here's 10 incidents that we've had that go the last 3 months that have nothing to do with safety and health. And now this union wants to come in and be the third party representative. This is clearly not to aid your inspection, but to further their union, you know, their union campaign. And so I think the COSHO should be very sensitive to that. And again, their FAQs make that clear, that this is not to be used, you know, as anything but safety and health. And so if you have that kind of evidence in hand, I think it's going to be hard for the COSHO to say, yes, this is reasonably necessary for a safety and health inspection.
And what about, you mentioned safety committees at some point in the discussion here. Should businesses consider establishing safety committees for purposes of this walk around rule, or more generally, does that depend on the nature of the business or the size?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are, look, I, as a former OSHA prosecutor and someone that, you know, does a lot of this work, I mean, I think safety committees can be very valuable in creating stronger workplace safety policies and practices and a culture, quite frankly, and getting employee involvement is always something OSHA loves to see. So even if you get citations, if you can point to, you know, a safety committee employee involvement, they're easier to defend against or even negotiate down. So I, you know, but to your point, like, look, resources are always limited, right? So if you are a law firm, is that necessary? You know, probably not. But if you are, you know, in industries where, you know, you may have, you know, hazards, employees exposed to like greater hazards, yes, I think it makes sense. You know, is this, would this necessarily be the only reason you do it? No, but if you do it, which again, I think generally speaking is a good idea, subject to, again, some of the things you just talked about, sort of driving the need to do that, you could build this in, right? You can say, okay, we're going to have this safety committee. These are the employee representatives, and you guys designate who you want as the walk around. And, you know, 99% of the time, they're going to designate someone from the company, right? So then you avoid this whole third party thing. So I think that's a great way to get ahead of this issue. And again, to, you know, it's hopefully going to strengthen your safety culture and your practices, your safety policies anyways. But yes, I mean, I think that's also one thing that employers can do to think about and potentially implement to get ahead of this, to take away that issue of who's going to be the third party representative. Well, we know who it's going to be. The safety committee says it's going to be this person.
So the walk-around rule notwithstanding, and I guess let's assume that it becomes effective in May and there's no further challenge or activity on that. Are we expecting any other developments on the OSHA front in the next, I don't know, 6 months that employers might want to keep an eye on?
Yeah, I think the biggest one that's going to, you know, the one that is going to affect at least the greatest number of employers is heat stress. It's pretty far along in the rulemaking process.
What is it?
It's exposure to the sun, right? The rule is going to cover both indoor and outdoors, right? Obviously, you could be working in a warehouse and be subject to, you know, very high heat conditions. So, there's been a lot of employee advocacy groups that are hoping that that comes out before the summer, which is obviously just around the corner. I think we're probably going to see that rule sooner rather than later. Another one that's started the formal process of rulemaking is a workplace violence rule for healthcare services. I'm not sure. I think 6 months is that's not probably realistic, but that's, you know, that process has started. So those are the two ones that I would, you know, keep an eye on, particularly if you're, you know, if employees exposed to, you know, heat stress or if you're in healthcare.
And I love to give a plug for other social media platforms, particularly at our firm, Cozen O'Connor here. I know you've got one for those who are interested in all things OSHA, or you work in a particular organization where these issues may be particularly relevant to you. What is it that you put out there, John?
Well, our firm has a safety and health blog. It's at OSHAChronicle.com. So obviously free to subscribe to. And we you know, talk about everything from practical tips on, look, things you should think about when you produce documents to OSHA, what to expect to it for OSHA, talk about some of the things we talked about today, upcoming rules, the rulemaking process. So it covers the whole gamut of safety and health issues, both legal and practical, Mike. So I appreciate you letting me make that plug.
Absolutely. OSHAChronicle.com is where you can find it. And John Ho, a partner here at Cozen O'Connor, resident in the New York office. But you can find him all over the place these days dealing with a lot of these hot OSHA issues for clients. John, as always, thank you for joining the podcast. I'm sure we'll have you back to talk about either further activity on this walk-around rule or other OSHA activities. But thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
So a lot is happening. As you have heard in Monday's part one and today's part two, a lot is happening on the federal agency level. The Department of Labor with its new overtime exemption rule, the EEOC with its new controversial broad regulations, giving guidance for the new federal Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, the FTC and its new expansive and broad rule on non-compete agreements, and OSHA in its new walk-around rule, expanding those that must be permitted to walk around during an OSHA inspection. There's a lot going on, and we are here to try to break it down. I am confident that in the next several days and the next few weeks, we will be hearing more about these actual issues, whether through litigation or otherwise, and we will continue to keep you posted on all of these developments as they happen. Please continue to send your feedback on this podcast to me, whether it's about topics discussed or whether it's about topics you would like to have discussed. I appreciate all of you sending your feedback over the years, and I appreciate all of you listening to this podcast as always. And until the next time, I hope all of your labor is productive.